listen, think, learn, grow. Listen, think, learn, grow. Live.
This is the Spirit of Life Metaphysics Radio Program, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Michael Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening and welcome to the Spirit of Life program for Wednesday, September 14th. My name is Michael Kelly and I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening, Michael. Glad to be here as always.
So glad to have you and welcome to those joining us live and those listening to the archives. We appreciate the time that you take to catch up with us. And those joining us live, thank you so much for your contributions. And I love seeing you each and every week. Spirit of Life is a weekly service and educational program of the International Church of Metaphysical Humanism. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit as well as to explore science and spirituality. In addition to this broadcast, ICMH offers other educational programs that can be found at metaphysicsinstitute.org and tfuniversity.org. As always, we're going to begin tonight with our 9 abbreviated principles of belief. Those are 1. Do no harm, do right. 2. We believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3. We believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems. 4. We are all equal, one planet, one race, one ancestry, one destiny. 5. We recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6. We are physical and spiritual beings. Consciousness survives death of the physical body. 7. Self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will create self-completeness. 8. Metaphysical education and practical life skills empower the human spirit and enhance the human condition. And 9. Expanding human consciousness leads to human evolution and peaceful coexistence. All right. Tonight, we will be getting into animal consciousness, but unfortunately, we had a little bit of an issue with Dr. Mike.
I'm here.
Oh.
I made it.
All right. Hey. Hey. Yay. Hey, yeah, we are good to go. I thought we were going to have some technical issues, but...
No, God. Well, we did. It's called I'm getting old, and I couldn't remember my password.
Oh. That has nothing to do with that. I mean, heck, when you get to be my age, I mean, I have trouble remembering those passwords. That's why I have Apple.
You're a youngster.
Anyway, so glad to have you, and so excited because, you know, this is just a beautiful topic when it comes to having you on, because we're going to talk about animal consciousness, and who better than somebody with the experience that you do. And,
so I'd like to open with a question to Dr. Mike. When you think of animal consciousness, how do you define it?
Well, I mean, there's a couple ways to do it. There's actually a technical way, and it's actually called the mirror test, which is called, it's actually a mirror self-recognition test. And they've performed it on a lot of different animals. Basically, they're trying to find out if a non-human type thing has the ability of self-recognition.
Ah.
And I don't know how many animals they've tried it on, but animals that, in fact, are able to recognize themselves are things like elephants, pretty well all the great apes.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, bottlenose dolphin.
Really?
Yeah. I heard that, and that doesn't surprise me at all.
Your favorite, orcas.
Yes, you read my mind. They are. Just, reading about them, watching some of the documentaries that have come up, especially, some of the... I think that it was really the documentary Blackfish. Do I remember that correctly? That kind of brought to light some of
that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it brought to light some of the treatment, at the different water parks and things that they'd undergone. But, they have very long lifespans. They have, regional dialects of whale song. They seem to be able to communicate and coordinate well. you know, they're just the level of intelligence is always fascinated me, and that makes me think about awareness and what does it mean to be self-aware. You had mentioned the mirror test.
Yeah.
I know we all love our dogs and our cats. Do animals on that level, have they passed the mirror test at any time?
That's kind of iffy. The problem with dogs is that they recognize each other by smell. And so when they see the reflection, you know, it's you can't really tell if they're actually recognize themselves or not because there's no scent.
You know, one thing, I don't know if, you know, my dogs are able to use a mirror, or cats for them, I don't know, able to use a mirror for, you know, recognizing themselves, but I will say I have a, you know, standing mirror in my bedroom, and when it faces the hall, so sometimes, especially my dog Ollie, if he's getting into something mischievous, if he's been a little miscreant, he'll be in the bedroom and he'll watch the mirror to see if I'm coming towards the bedroom. So if he sees me in the mirror, he knows I'm coming, and then he'll dive under the bed.
Well, and, you know, we all know, you know, that the dogs and cats are extremely smart.
Right.
But I mean, when it comes to the definition of intelligence,
right,
they don't quite meet the grade, so to speak.
And I don't think they, I don't think they can, just based on, you know, I think last week we were talking about the analogy of, you know, consciousness being a multi-layered thing. I used the analogy that I stole from somewhere, and I wish I could credit who it was. The brain is kind of like a computer. You have the hardware, you know, the genetic attributes that go into your mental faculties, the software, you know, the lessons you learn in life, education, and then education you find out in the world and things that you learn on your own, all of those different things that are instilled in you. And then the other component being the user, you know, the soul, the thing that goes into it, the consciousness. And the computing power of an animal on the level of a dog or a cat, as far as we know, I think it's just not there to be what we would consider self-aware. As much as I love them.
I'd kind of agree with that. But surprisingly, some of the other things that they found that passed the mirror test, certain species of ants.
Really?
I heard that.
Yeah. And there's one that I'm not sure if they've done the mirror test on or not, but probably one of the most intelligent critters are octopus.
You just read my mind. I was going to ask you about, have they done a mirror test on an octopus?
You know, I don't know. I'd have to look and see. But here's the thing. There's a lot of geneticists and biologists that actually think octopi are alien life forms. And the reason they say that is, if you look at it, the human has 23 chromosomes, and, you know, 20,000 genes, okay? An octopus has 28 chromosomes.
Wow.
And almost 34,000 genes. Huh. So it's kind of like, I mean, what exactly does that mean? Don't know, but there's no other creature that we know of that are like an octopi.
And, you know, it just kind of brings back the idea of, you know, where does the mind exist? Because I'm sorry, I was reading, catching up on the chat. I don't know if you'd reference this or not, and stop me if you did. The idea that, you know, octopus doesn't have a brain like we do, mammals or even lizards that we know of do. It's, you know, dispersed and very varied. And they're, they perceive life in an entirely different way. And I think that's what kind of this that we're going to is all about. You know, perception is so much of consciousness, right?
But what would be the second thing? So you said, Mike, that there's two ways, one being the mirror test. What would be the other way they determine consciousness in animals?
Oh, did I say two?
Yeah, I thought you did off the top. But
well, the only
not.
One I know of is the mirror test.
That's the one I thought. I thought I'd missed something there for a second. I don't know if I heard that two either, but... You know, I think language is an interesting one. I don't know if it necessarily indicates being self-aware per se as much as it indicates a higher level of, you know, the ability to think and reason.
When they communicate, I mean, you know, like dolphins, orcas, whales, all those have very complex social groups. And they interact by actually talking to each other.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that you requires a certain level of intelligence to be able to comprehend and to, you know, to have that more complex linguistic system as opposed to, you know, ants or bees, which do have complex organizations, but it's based on pheromone and just pure instinct as opposed to, you know, expressing an idea and getting something in return.
You know, I have a question for Mike, if I may. Maybe not entirely regarding consciousness, but on along that vein. There's now been these incidents where whales have attacked boats, and especially off of Europe there, and where some ocean creatures have been, you know, more aggressive than we have known them to be. But equally, and me trying to have an overview, the same has been said now of coyotes and various other species showing aggression. It, and again, in a way that we're not accustomed to, you know, to seeing them. So could it be that environmentally, like the heightened frequencies, for instance, electromagnetic frequencies, radiation, and of course all the sounds that go on in the ocean.
Oh yeah, it's terrible.
And could that be affecting their?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's been attributed to a lot of different types of whales beaching themselves.
I mean,
yeah, there's so much noise pollution that. You know, well, I mean, fundamentally, they're pissed off.
And, you know, in a... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just, you know, I think it's all environmental, yeah.
I was just going to say, you know, with expanding human cities, you know, settlements in different suburbs, all of that, the natural resources are being eaten up more and more for our use, leaving a smaller and smaller share of the ecological pie for a lot of these different species, not to mention the oceans being depleted, all of these things, and when you're hungry, you're angry.
So,
a recent study of
malnutrition with some of the whales, which they have hormone problems, and that's part of the breeding issues.
Right now in Southern California, they're having a real problem with seals being malnourished.
Okay, aside from the food source, this is where if we're observing consciousness and these animals, you know, different species of animals, whether they're land or ocean, can be affected in their temperament by, you know, pulsations in the air, frequencies, air, and so on. Does that not give more credibility to their consciousness, them having consciousness?
Yeah, it's a good point, yeah.
Because if they're not conscious, and like if we're a flatliner kind of way of thinking, that they don't have a consciousness and they're all instinctual, you know, animals eat animals, then they wouldn't necessarily react. But they have certain nervous systems and their behaviors change. So it's more than instinct. It's more like in that, again, I'm going back to that word because it's the only one I can find at the moment, that they are conscious beings, even if they're not self-aware, you know, by something like a mirror test, that they're aware enough of their surroundings and environment that their behaviors are affected. That, to me, indicates a consciousness of some kind.
I kind of agree with that.
Absolutely. And I was just going to say, you know, I think ultimately every living thing has to be, you know, aware of themselves in a fundamental way because they have to protect themselves from danger. Whether they have the capacity to philosophically reflect on it and, you know, really think about their mortality, I just don't think there's the computing power. But, you know, our pets think in the abstract. Dogs, you know where they hide things. They plan on things. They look forward to things. It's just, again, what kind of computing power do you have behind it that allows you that consciousness to fully bloom. I've always had the argument that in humanity you will find the very best that nature has to offer and the very worst that nature has to offer, because humanity has the intelligence to fully exhibit that full spectrum of consciousness. But
so I sorry, go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to finish by saying that so I wonder, you know, how much that our perceptions of what is consciousness, what is awareness, you know, and maybe the separation of there's humanity and then there's everything else is not as sharp as, you know, we commonly believe.
Well, we assume that animals think in English. That's our problem.
Well, I know mine do.
Yeah.
But I have a question, Dr. Mike. You've worked a lot with sharks, correct?
Yeah.
So what's your take on that level of awareness within the various species of sharks and their, I would say, their personality traits? Because, you know, they're given a bad rap, right?
Well,
But are they that way,
they are.
Really?
And it depends on which species you're talking about. But all sharks are very aware of their surroundings. Mm. And they have exceptional sensory electrical, basically. There's little openings on the end of their nose called the ampullae of Lorenza, and those things are electrical sensors. I mean, They could feel a critter's heartbeat, you know, a long, long ways off.
Is that kind of like a bat instinct?
Yeah, bats or sonar type thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that would be more like dolphins use echolocation.
But actual sharks can actually sense electrical pulses.
Yeah, I've heard
and,
that.
And a long way, they also have an excellent sense of smell. They can smell blood in the water a mile away. I think sharks are very, very smart, but depending on the species, they're extremely unpredictable.
Yeah.
How many species are there of sharks?
Oh, God, there's hundreds of them.
Oh, really?
You know,
yeah.
I was just going to say, just from my, you know, Shark Week watching, I think of, you know, like tiger sharks and bull sharks as kind of the most aggressive around humans.
That's true. Bull sharks are.
Yeah.
Tiger sharks really aren't.
Oh.
I mean, they are aggressive, but it depends on, I mean, let's take a bull shark, for example. A bull shark likes murky water. And they'll be in water that's 2 or 3 feet deep. They're the only shark species that can survive in fresh water.
I didn't know that.
Anywhere there is a estuary or river flowing into the water, like around the Gulf or the East Coast, you go up that and you're going to have bull sharks.
Mm.
They have actually caught a bull shark 2,000 miles up the Amazon. You know, it's kind of one of those things where they like murky water. They also like, you know, it's kind of one of those, depending on the beach and you know, they have little shoals and things like that. But dusk and dawn, don't go in the water.
Yeah, good advice.
You know, do you consider a bull shark quite aware?
Oh yeah.
Conscious wise?
Well, I don't. You know, there again, conscious to me is kind of like when you start talking about conscious, it's almost like, well, are we talking about self-aware?
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's. You know, I can't really say.
Well, I kind of think it would be, I mean, when we think of, you know, orcas, other dolphin species, whales, I think we can apply to them kind of a mammalian emotional intelligence that we're more familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I think of sharks as having an intelligence, but they're just, they don't think the way that a species like ours does in the same, in that way. They, you know, they're a predator species. And, you know, thinking about bull sharks, you know, I'd always heard the stories that they would go up river. And I live here in Southwest Florida when we're on a harbor that's connected to the Gulf. And when I was 13 and my friends were using a tree rope to jump into the Peace River that flows into the harbor through the, in the end of the Gulf, all I'm thinking in my head at this time before I'm about to jump in due to peer pressure is there's either going to be a big gator or a bull shark in there and I'm about to die.
Very true. You know, so it, you know, and bull sharks are the most, to me, the most aggressive. They're very unpredictable. I've been in the water with just about all the kinds of sharks, and the one that I'm the most leery about are bull sharks.
Mm-hmm. So you said a really important point there in defining consciousness and why it's so questionable is, you know, the definition of self and being self-aware versus maybe not self-aware. And then we intellectually use a mirror test to gauge that. But just because something isn't necessarily self-aware doesn't mean there isn't a consciousness at work.
I'd go with that.
And I think one thing that has come to mind, too, in regards to things like the mirror test is a big part of that is you have to care. The animal has to care about it being there. You know, it might just not be a, it might not be a thing of importance. It's all about motivation and how they see the world, too. And like you had said, there's no smell to it. So for them, it's just an interesting thing, but it may not have anything to do with their sense of self. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, we talked about sharks and, you know, these kind of predatory species. Do you think that it's common in the evolutionary world where predators, simply by the nature of their needing to be cunning and strategizing, do they naturally have a higher intelligence and the ability to think and that, you know, computing power than you might consider an herbivore?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you take...
orcas have kind of evolved where they know how to herd, you know,
their
prey.
Yeah, they're very smart. Yeah.
And I think about, well, you know, I just go off the list of predators that come to mind. Your big cats. We know that they're very intelligent. Smarter than our house cats, of course. You take... wolves, hunt and pack, tactics, organized, led to dogs, intelligent. I think about bears. Bears are very intelligent. You know, one of the most intelligent. Of course, you know,
Yogi Bear?
Yep. There's also this tweet that came from, I think it was Yellowstone. And they were talking about, you know, they're often asked why they can't come up with a trash can that bears won't be able to get into. And the response was, unfortunately, there is significant overlap between the intelligence of the smartest bear and the dumbest tourist.
Well, there, you know, when you start talking about intelligence in humans, I still question that.
You know, there's a question in the chat Dr. Ione is asking, so good one for Dr. Mike here. Is instinct related to consciousness? What do you think about that?
Well...
Or do you think they're connected or separate?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I look at instinct as genetically it's there. And you don't really have to think about it.
Right.
You know,
so, you know, I think that when you start talking about self-aware, I think that's a little higher order than your basic, you know, genetic hardwired instinct.
Well, let's bring it back to humans as a, you know, an analogy kind of thing. We obviously have instinct. I mean, why do we build houses, commune in cities, things like this? It's all instinct. The intelligence aspect, to me, comes into play in how you execute that instinct. So we all have instincts. We all have this programming that come from prior generations, that proven genetic memory of lessons and, you know, things to be afraid of that go from generation to generation built into us. But the degree of intelligence we have is how well we can implement that instinct, how much we can deviate from the strictness of it and perhaps be creative and advance the instinct.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I wonder too, because I had a horse that could unlock any gate imaginable. And really, even using a padlock, he would rub his bum up against the hinges to wear them down. You know, and that takes an enormous amount of intelligence, I think, that he knows it can open, but he's just got to figure it out. And so he's trying to figure it out in whatever way. And that to me is, that's a pretty smart horse.
It is. My favorite part of that story is that you referenced the bum. But yeah. Let's move on. Dr. Mike, you were saying?
Do what?
As I started to talk, I realized I was just cutting you off. I didn't mean to.
Oh, I was going to say, another critter that is very smart are crows.
Hmm.
Yes, yeah. They are.
Oh, this has been going around, and it's, you know, internet, I love science and things like that, that you can see on different social medias. So I haven't gone into it in depth, but Dr. Mike, you might have already heard of this or be more aware of it than I, but it's a story of an experiment wherein they put meat or food in a jar, and they gave two crows two different pieces of metal that they could then use to get at the food in the jar. One was bent, which means it couldn't get into the opening to get to the food, and the other was straight. So they gave them both the pieces, they went for it, they picked it up, and they had them separated, but they could see one another. So they wanted to determine if they could reason. They put them through the experiment again, and this time they were thinking, okay, if they can reason, they're both going to go for the straight one because they'll realize that's the one that works. But instead, they come together, one holds the piece of metal with the bend in it, while the other straightens it out, and then they both have straight, you know, pieces of metal to get food, and they take it and they get the food, and they both do it without verbal communication.
They've done similar things with octopi. They'll put a glass jar with a food source in it and screw the lid on it and let it sink to the bottom. And in short order, the octopi has gone in and unscrewed the lid and got the food.
We're thinking consciousness.
Well, yeah, think about it. That's for sure.
Yeah. Be able to conceptualize, strategize.
Exactly. You know, this is where, and of course you've had a lot more experience with animals, studying animals, Dr. Mike, than certainly I have. But I've been around them my whole life, but that doesn't necessarily mean I study them like you do. And so I guess having an understanding, and what are the primary questions that biologists ask when it comes to the study of the animal kingdom and looking for consciousness?
Well, I'm not sure if they actually look for consciousness. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where it's more, it's all classified. You know, where are they? You know, what family kingdom and phylum and all that, and you know how they work basically. They're, you know, then, you know, depending on what you're doing, if you're a geneticist, you're trying to figure out, you know, all the gene sequence and things like that. So, you know, the reality is, I'm not really sure if a lot of thought is put into consciousness. I mean, you know, until recently, you know, been aware of that kind of a thought process. I mean, I know they come in and say, well, this animal is very smart and this animal is very smart. Do they, you know, are they to the point where they're they have consciousness. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where you almost think they should, they do, because they actually analyze their environment.
Well, Dr. Kevin is asking in the chat about if animals can entertain or do entertain suicidal thoughts.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, we were just talking, you had mentioned whales that beach themselves earlier, right?
Uh-huh.
But do they intend to?
Well, I would think that whales, well, who am I to speak on the subject? I was thinking the whales surely have the intelligence to know that if they beach themselves, they're not going to be able to get away from it.
Well, you know, it's kind of one of the things, if their whole sensory system is all screwed up because of some environmental thing, they may not know that they've actually beached themselves.
Mm.
And, for example, there have been a couple orcas that have killed themselves, if lack of a better term, at SeaWorld.
Mm.
And was it intentionally, or was it something, you know, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, indications are that, you know, there's
distress.
Something.
Yeah, yeah.
Distress.
Well, you know, I think as emotional beings.
If I can just interject, though, I think depression, I mean, that's proven, isn't it, Dr.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, yeah. Animals, you know, they do get depressed. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why people come down on people like SeaWorld and so forth like that. Now, I'm a SeaWorld advocate. I was raised in San Diego. My best friend was the actual individual who collected the SeaWorld orcas back in the 70s and 80s.
Oh.
I know how SeaWorld treated them. I know what all extent they went to. And contrary to what a lot of people think, they were treated extremely well. Now, they have a small environment.
Yeah.
They, to a large degree, lack the social environment that they're used to. And so, yeah, could it lead to depression? I actually think so, yeah.
You
know, things you notice about orcas in captivity. You know, their dorsal fin. You know, they, you know, depending on the length and everything of the orca, they'll stick up 4 or 5 feet in the air.
Yeah.
And you'll notice that a lot of the orcas in captivity are curled over.
Right.
And
yeah.
They have no idea why. Me, I think it could be depression.
So
biologically, are there no bones in that dorsal fin?
No.
Or is it muscle?
It's cartilage.
Yeah.
Cartilage, okay.
You know, I have to agree with you, Dr. Mike, on when it comes to the people that work at places like SeaWorld, and they're so often, you know, very caring and very, you know, well-intentioned. And I think that what you just said, you know, orcas especially are very intelligent beings, and it's a small environment. I don't think they're necessarily mistreated per se as much as a creature so intelligent, you know, it's a pain. Would any human want to live in a similar existence, and how far down on the self-aware consciousness intelligence scale are they really? And I think that doesn't apply just to orcas. You know, my rule on zoos, and I knew zoos are becoming more and more controversial as our awareness of what consciousness and life entails. And I think a good rule of thumb is this. If the animal in question doesn't have a problem existing in captivity, then there's no harm to it. But there are certain beings that just, they don't thrive. They can't thrive in captivity. It's just almost impossible.
Well, that's one reason why you never see a great white in an aquarium.
Mm. Yeah.
They don't last.
Yeah.
How long have they lasted? What's the average?
Not very long. There are a few aquariums that actually have whale sharks, which is primarily the thing I've been studying.
Interesting. Must be massive.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, whale sharks, the longest one recorded was 60 feet.
Wow.
Back in the 20s and 30s. Nowadays, you know, 40 feet maybe and it's primarily the females. But you know, they a lot of aquariums tried to capture and put them in tanks, and they just don't like, they don't live very long.
Mm-hmm.
The big aquarium, I think it's Georgia Aquarium, has one. They had two or three, two of them died. And there's one other big aquarium in Japan that has had somewhat limited success. But I mean, they're just, you know, they're very temperamental.
So Dr. Ione is saying in the chat that depression's related to chemical imbalance. And there's another comment from Dr. Edwards saying, but emotions can trigger chemical imbalance. I want your take on this, Dr. Mike, but I'm going to say I don't think you have to have a chemical imbalance to be depressed. Does that make sense? Like, you're the biologist, so...
Yeah, that's...
I'm thinking about the whale who was went into that massive depression when her young, her calf died, and she carried it on her back.
Oh, yeah, they do. I mean, you know, bears do it. You know, most of your, what I would consider, you know, larger, higher intelligent, they mourn.
So that's a form of depression that doesn't have to be a chemical imbalance. That's emotion.
Well,
I think emotions have something to do with it. Now, chemical imbalance, I think that's something that, you know, I mean, it's probably true about most anything.
Yeah.
But as far as depression goes, I think it could be environmental factors.
Mm.
You know, unfortunately,
unhappy's unhappy.
We don't know much as we think we know.
Hmm. Well, true, words that's never spoken, true. But. I just, you know, and I, my mind comes to a lot of times. I was in the St. Louis Zoo back in 2014, and it was on a company event, and we had the kind of place to ourselves. And I was just going around, and I was looking at the orangutan and, you know, a holding pen. And, you know, there were things to play with and places to jump, but he was just kind of sitting next to the window, and he just looked so sad. And I don't know if I was projecting my own, you know, anthropomorphizing it or anything, but... I just, you know, remember really feeling for him and realizing that, you know, something like this shouldn't be in a place where it's just, you know, gawked at. And, go ahead.
No, the only thing I'd like to inject here is because, and again, Dr. Mike, please, I want your take on this. I think a lot of zoos now are trying to preserve species because of poaching, because of, and giraffes are one, you know, there's a lot of species that are now in captivity just to preserve and expand the species.
Very true. So, and I agree. In fact, I had been thinking about that earlier. And I meant to... Dr. Mike, of course.
Dr. Mike?
Well, the thing about preserving the species is the thing that gets me is they always follow up with, and we'll return them to the wild. Well, number one, you know, to a limited extent they could. But why would you want to take an endangered species, return to the wild, only to have it poached?
Mm-hmm. It only works if you have a state that is strong enough to, you know, keep the poachers out. And, you know, I think they've had some limited successes in certain places. I think one, you know, prime example of this is it was, you know, on NPR recently. I can't remember the name of it, but it's essentially a mini horse. Looks like a small Shetland, and it's native to Canada and North United States. It had dwindled to a mere handful of members, and they were rescued by an indigenous tribe in, I think, the Ottawa province, and, you know, rehabilitated over decades, and now they're being reintroduced to the wild. And, of course, in a place like that, there aren't really natural predators. It was humans that were using them for industrial things and just poor breeding practices, and they weren't terribly useful for manual labor and things like that. But I think it's, yeah, to your point, exactly, reintroducing an endangered species to an environment where it's still in danger is not the way to do it. It has to be something more systemic and fundamental on the ground level.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, it, you know, it's kind of one of those things, like what they're trying to do with the black rhino. Mm. There's only one living black rhino left.
Right.
And it's surrounded by armed guards 24/7.
Yeah.
And it's a female. And what they're trying to do is take the old ones from a black rhino and artificially inseminate a white rhino, and the result would be a black rhino calf. Mm. And they're actually working on that.
I mean, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Dr. Mike. I've always heard that in order to truly rehabilitate a population in a healthy way, you have to have a bare minimum of, you know, people. Like, I think in this situation, maybe it's obviously a different situation, but I'd, you know, read in a couple articles, and I'd seen at least one documentary where they essentially say if the human population ever gets down to just two people, we're pretty much doomed already. That's not enough people to restart the human race. There's just not enough genetic diversity there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct, or am I misled on that?
Well, I mean, you know, that's kind of...
Well, we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, at what point in time is a species doomed? Well, that's all going to depend on what, you know, environmental predators, you know, different things like that. I mean, sure, given time, two people could.
But in the terms of, you know, the genetic health of the offspring, you know, and how many generations would it be that, they would be able to continue functioning with an immune system or be able to, you know, not have deformities and things like that?
I mean, I'd say pretty well, you got down to, it's pretty well, you know, canceled.
Yeah. Well, another thing is, you know, that's another thing that's always been about the Bible and Genesis. If Adam and Eve had kids, then where did the... So basically, you know, that kind of incest was just the norm for a few hundred years at least.
Well,
they were aliens.
Well, back in the, you know, if you look at, go back and look at, you know, like the Anunnaki and look at the Sumerians and things like that.
The Ptolemies.
Even the Egyptians in the... Pharaoh's family and all that. I mean, you know, incest was, you know, all over the place.
Ptolemy dynasty of, you know, Cleopatra's time, which was the Greek, well, the Greekish Macedonians that had come down in Alexander the Great's time. The Ptolemies, they, you know, married their sisters for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get some cousins thrown in every now and again, but that was kind of a, you know, biological experiment in and of itself. But...
So if we can go back, I'm trying to bring it back to the beginning here about consciousness. I hope you don't mind. Because, we could talk for hours, Dr. Mike here, because, you know, often tangents about the animal kingdom because you're the specialist. Where do you think science is right now in wanting to study animals in a new way? How has it changed from when you first started to where you are now? And what the direction is.
Well,
do you feel?
When Darwin and I were on the Beagle, we had a completely different look.
Yeah.
A lot of it is based now on what they're doing with genetics.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think DNA is revealing so much. Our ability to kind of examine genetic code and to kind of bring this back around to humanity just one last time. One thing that it was a Discovery Channel documentary years ago when they had things like that on Discovery still. It was talking about potential human development and evolution. They said that when they looked into the human genome, they found a bottleneck, you know, many, many thousands, you know, tens and tens of thousands of years ago. Maybe longer, that was a point where there could have only been maybe between 500 and 1,000 humans on the whole planet. Because for genetic diversity among species, it was a relatively small amount, and we share a lot of commonality with those ancient ancestors. So, you know, just kind of to think about the human race being endangered at one point is, and now look at us now. It just goes to show you how things come around. But
I know, but for Dr. Mike, in what you're studying at the moment, is there an attitude change? I guess that's what I'm looking for.
An attitude change towards?
Towards the study of animals, like the methodology, the view of it, the consciousness
of it. Respecting the consciousness of the animal?
Well,
yeah, I think so. I mean, I would, you know, I would like to think so. It, you know, not everything is a test tube.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think when you start looking at the primary areas that are focused, they're going to be on, you know, gene therapy, you know, different gene splicing and different things like that on trying to improve, you know, a species.
Mm-hmm.
The other big topics are going to be things like on the cellular, molecular level. What are they, you know, what's going on there? So, I mean, yeah, I think the attitude has changed a lot. And it looks like, I mean, when I got back in the 70s, when I first graduated, DNA was just kind of a thought.
Mm.
And, you know, it was very in its infancy. Well, look at it now. So, yeah, I think a lot of that stuff that they're working on nowadays, you know, has a tendency to try to improve a species, in mm-hmm. particular its survival,
mm-hmm.
And so forth. So, I mean, that's why I think a lot of zoos, you know, are into the species survival program, and that's why they move animals from one zoo to another so that they can, you know, produce a better genetic offspring.
And like the panda.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like the panda. But I mean, I think the ones that I'm more aware of are like the rhino. In particular, and it's kind of, you know, all over.
Yeah.
Well, and I imagine when the numbers get that low, it takes such special care to make sure that the, you know, looking for genetic health, now that we know so much about DNA.
That's one of the primary bases of the species survival is the genetic viability of, you know, a pair of animals. Is one zoo has a better generic version of, let's say, a zebra, and another one has, you know, a comparative, you know, male, let's say, they will ship them one to another so that they can produce a more genetic, pure offspring.
Yeah.
Not
read, but you know, so you know, they're constantly shifting animals around.
I have another question right along that line. Then is, and only because I talked to she was a PhD in biochemistry about 25 years ago, and in our discussion, she said you'd be amazed what they're splicing this DNA with that DNA.
Oh yeah.
And how does that? I mean, and so to be fair to everybody, like splicing a bear with a monkey.
I don't think that would work.
Well, and one of the things was putting it in space so it would actually, you know, hibernate or being able to sleep for long periods of time, but. You know, get the intelligence. So all this kind of messing around.
Like, they're just trying to create the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you got the Jurassic World type thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they actually think that they could bring back some dinosaur species.
Well, yeah.
But to me, I'm going, I'm not sure about that.
Well, then I wonder about the consciousness of that.
Does a clone have the same kind of consciousness as a creature born in a, well, quote-unquote natural way?
You've got clone cheap. You've got mm-hmm. clones, yeah. you know, and they all act the same.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's a good question. And Dr. Yeah. Mike, would you consider cloning? Like, where would the consciousness be in a cloned animal?
It'd probably be, I mean, well, a cloned animal is going to go through development the same as a regular animal.
Yeah. And
I mean, it's not, there's no difference other than its chromosomal makeup is identical.
Well, and here's another, I think another interesting thing. We're talking about animal consciousness, and, you know, I think that has to be kind of intertwined with concepts of a soul. And I think, Dr. Vicky, mm-hmm. you're kind of intimating, does a cloned creation have a soul the same as a, you know, thing born in a natural manner? Which I think leads to my hypothesis that what we would kind of consider a soul, whatever that means to you, is born through awareness and through consciousness and maybe through, you know, a little bit of suffering too. But yeah, I also want to throw out some contributions we've gotten from our chat, and thank you everybody for joining us. Tabitha, we have a newer member of our community here. She's thrown out a good couple of good points, most recent of which is something that she had read, where to have a healthy population in the gene pool, in the viable gene pool, you want at least 50 to 200 as a minimum, and kind of related to some crypto ideas about, you know, small Sasquatch populations and the great areas of North America, which is, you know, an interesting point when we talk about the genetics of animals and, you know, kind of getting into those kind of viability things. But something I also want to touch on earlier that she had thrown out there, and I think I'm remembering this correctly, wherein talking about human attitudes towards animals as almost a desire to think that they don't have any consciousness. They're essentially robotic, you know, robots made of, you know, bone and sinew, to make it more palatable for hunters and for butchers and things like that to deal with them in a more, you know, mechanical way, kind of thing like mm-hmm. that. Is that something that you think is really, would you say, colored historic human attitudes towards animals and our ideas of their ability to have a consciousness and evolved awareness?
Well, I think my first thought is, you know, let's take a cow. Most people in the United States, quite frankly, if they went through a cow processing plant, they would probably never eat meat again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, it, you know, when it comes to, you know, just, you know, there are people that just doesn't bother them, okay? That's just their makeup. But when it comes to things like cloning, to me, if you clone something, they're going to be an identical replication of its, quote, offspring, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include, you know, intelligence, everything else. I mean, I don't know why there would be any different, because mm-hmm. they're going to go through the same development process, and they're going to have the same DNA. Mm-hmm. Now, DNA is going to determine
mm-hmm.
everything.
It's that kind of, you know, software going into the instinct,
you know,
the makeup.
So, you know, if you've got that same DNA, why wouldn't you have the same thought process? I mean, obviously, you're going to think differently and stuff like that, but the same awareness, the same, you know, everything else. Mm-hmm. And if consciousness is involved, why wouldn't it?
Well,
I love these questions.
And that just brings me to the next obvious, you know, logical next step in this discussion is, when I eventually have a clone of myself, are we going to be friends? I wonder how that's going to work.
But, you know, well, I mean, you know, there was a movie, and I can't remember the name of it, where the guy basically downloaded his thoughts into a computer. And the computer became aware, self-aware. I'm going, well, you know, I'm not sure if you can get a transistor to do that or not, mm-hmm. but, you know, they're, I mean, it's kind of one of those, you know, I guess it could. I mean, you know, they have completely mapped the genome of a fly, all X million synapses.
Mm-hmm.
and so forth. So if they could do that, why couldn't they do a human? We're talking about, instead of millions, we're talking about billions.
Well,
and so forth. But once you have that, what does that give you? You don't have the same chemical processes working. You don't have the same, it's obviously it's a simulation, more or less. Could something like that have an actual consciousness? To me, I don't think so. But a living cell, living thing, is extremely complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Dr. Zach has asked, if you transplant a brain, does the consciousness stay with the brain of the animal? And that's a really fascinating question that could be for another program, honestly, because we're talking cellular memory, epigenetic.
I don't see why it wouldn't be.
Well, and this just brings to mind the classic documentary of Young Frankenstein. And Dr. Frankenstein, yeah. I think is how he pronounced that. Yes.
Frankenstein,
yep. Well, I know that they used Mr. Abby Normal's brain, and I do believe that his consciousness did transpose into the new body. But we'll have to check on that source. But no, it is a fascinating concept, which comes into the place of, where does the mind exist? Is it in the brain solely, or is it in our,
Both.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to put it, too.
I think you have a chemical process. You have, all the stuff going on. But I think it's non-local.
Yeah, I think.
And I think a lot of that, because of a lot of the near-death experiences people have had,
mm-hmm.
especially with heart attacks, when they have actually no brain activity whatsoever, and they come back and they remember everything.
Yeah,
they even have out of body experiences and things like that. Well, that can't be local.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah, exactly. And so, that is something I would be interested in kind of delving into. We've had this kind of run on consciousness and the mind and where does it exist and all this. But the idea of, that, and what you were kind of referring to earlier about downloading your consciousness into a computer, I think is called the singularity.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's fascinating concepts. And, I'm good for a solid 5-hour broadcast. I don't know how we are, but we're coming up on an hour here, and we can just dive on into it. But I think,
as always, I'm just so grateful for you to come on, Dr. Mike, because I appreciate having a different viewpoint, and one as number one educated as yourself, and your life experiences and kind of your take on it. So I think that's really good for our audience. And certainly great for the conversation. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I don't even care about the audience. This is great for me. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. So thank you very much. We obviously, to our listeners, we are going to bypass our inner oracle and tarot cards this evening.
Sorry about that, folks.
This has been a fantastic discussion. I thoroughly appreciate it, and thank you so very much. And I just say, next week we'll pull cards, and they're going to be twice as meaningful. So, it's just, we're going to have that impact. But, thank you very much. And, I guess we're hitting that hour mark, so I think we'll kind of wrap it up. But, I'll give it to you first as our guest, Dr. Mike. Any last thoughts on this tonight?
Be kind to animals.
So true and so important, and our card keeper, Wendy, who was in chat, I want to give her a little credit here and a little shout out, because she has adopted a new puppy, a bulldog mix, that was from a litter that was unfortunately abandoned, thrown out of a car into a ditch, and they had to recover these. And it's because of amazing people like Wendy that I still have faith in us, but it's people that would do that to an animal that makes challenges that.
Well, those are the kind of people I would actually like to meet and have a conversation with for about 10 minutes.
You and me both, Dr. Mike. We'll make it 20 minutes. But
oh, mine would only be 30 seconds. It would be over.
But, I agree that there's big need for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
absolutely.
You so much, Dr. Mike, for joining us again.
Thank you. And absolutely. Absolutely. So I think we're going to, I'll talk, Dr. Vicky, you and I will chat. We'll kind of throw together some ideas maybe about Dr. Zach's topic, and we'll broadcast that for next week. We're kind of coming to a close. Dr. Vicky, any last thoughts that you want to throw out there?
I'm with Dr. Mike. Just be kind to animals. Be kind to each other.
I can't possibly top that, but yes, be kind to animals.
No, you can't.
Be kind to animals, then be kind to each other, in that order. I joke, but thank you, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Mike. This has been fantastic.
No problem. Thanks.
I appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. I hope you can join us next week. And until then, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.